Welcome to the Omfit podcast.
Hello and welcome back to part two of our discussion with Charles and Douglas. If you haven't listened to the first half already, I'd recommend checking out on Spotify or iTunes or whichever your chosen podcast platform is. In the first episode, we discussed China's fintech growth and how it became a global leader, its approach to regulations for fintechs and newer entrants, and we also outlined China's DCEP project. In this podcast, we continue the conversation on the PBOC's DCEP, how effective it could be in the current private sector-led market, and the potential economic challenges for the CBDC to move cross-border. So let's get straight back into it. Charles, just to turn to you for a second, we know from the trials so far that DCEP will likely work alongside and integrate with some of the current mobile applications on the market as a method of maybe dissemination of the currency. Do you think such an initiative is likely to firstly be effective in such a dominated market? And do you think there will be any disintermediation or disruption to commercial banking or maybe some of the incumbent fintechs in this space already?
To answer bluntly, I think yes and of course. And that's the whole point. I'll start backwards and then sort of end back at the front end. I think, as Dr. Arner pointed out, I think very, very eloquently, this is a very multifaceted issue. Okay. And if you look at SWIFT, you can look at that as the starting point just as much as the ending point. And that the sovereign currency being both an issue of actual trade and money flows, but also being important symbolically in the global, in terms of global citizenry. And you can then think and know that, you know, China has been talking about RMB internationalization for many years, certainly well before COVID and so forth, right? Even from the previous leadership with Party Secretary Hu. So, you know, RMB internationalization has been a core strategic goal for quite a long time. And then you add to that, you know, the so-called U.S.-China trade war. And then, as Dr. Arner very precisely said, catalyzed that with the recent year and all of the events he's already spoken about, then you'll see, you know, this did not happen by happenstance. This was not an accident by any stretch of imagination. This has been core strategic from a very, very high level, even up to the national security level. So when you ask, is it likely to be effective? It better be effective. You know, when you look at the reasons to do CBDC in the first place, Party Secretary Xi has been very forthright. He has not hidden that anti-graft is going to be at the core and has been at the core of his leadership since he began. And anti-graft is, you know, benefits very, very much from DCEP and its ability to monitor, track in an immutable way. You talk about the financial inclusion and indeed the simple management of a float when there's 1.7 billion people. And the costs associated with counterfeiting and that sort of thing, then, you know, the benefits are substantial. By some measure, I think the Bank of England came out and said that if even 30% of M1 becomes CBDC, that the benefits may be up to 3% of GDP. And China's stated goal is 100% of M1. And as you correctly pointed out, and again, I don't know that we see this as an obstacle, but rather a motivation. The fact that two large players cover 90% of this market, the fact that by some measures, as much as 80% of FMCG is in fact online. When you look at the growth rate of the internet retail space being upwards this year, of a positive 26% relative to, you know, a relative drop in comparable numbers offline, you'll start to see how important it is from the country strategically that the fate of its commerce does not lie solely in the hands of to service providers, but that rather actually, I think that CBDC and the way that it's been set up in its two-tier form has actually been designed to enable and empower banks. So without getting into too much detail on the actual structure, CBDC is designed to go through central bank into the state run, the four big banks, and then from there trickle through. So, you know, my feeling is that DSEP, the way it's set up now, is actually to empower the other payment players, guys like FlashPay, SanFu, which is part of the UnionPay system, and of course the other banks, to give them the ability to do seamless transaction on the backbone of DSEP, and in some ways balance what we're seeing in terms of the online retail and payments space. So you look at the early few, and again, this is how China works, right? That, you know, the first four cities, you know, with Shong'an and Shenzhen and Suzhou and Chengdu, to roll out, and then the limited use generally in transportation, but already we're starting to see that is already a disintermediation activity. Okay. And will that disenfranchise, I'll use a different word, disenfranchise incumbent fintechs? I'm not so sure. I think the space is big enough that moving away from traditional methods of payment may still be a net positive for a number of fintechs. But does it mean that in general, there will be sort of less sort of reliance upon a small number of players? I do think that is its purpose. So I do think that it will be effective. It has shown itself to have moved with significant momentum over the last year, or, you know, call it 16, 17 months. And that momentum is substantially positive. So we haven't seen it fall on its face yet. And that, I think, is a good sign for something that really is sort of so unique and a first mover globally.
Thank you, Charles. Yes, I think the effects are yet to be seen, whether it drives greater competition in payment service providers and fintechs leveraging off the DSEP. We don't know yet. Douglas, just a question for you. In the DSEP's current state, it is to be operable within national borders, and Charles already mentioned the cross-border narrative as well. Do you foresee the DSEP likely to become available for cross-border payments? And would China want to do this, given that this could mean greater liberalization of the capital account and possibly even allowing for the renminbi, the digital renminbi, to be freely available and even be floated?
It's interesting, and I completely, if we look at, and Charles' point is exactly right, if we look at RMB internationalization, this was an objective that really emerged in the aftermath of the 2008 financial crisis, and a realization perhaps of an over-reliance on the U.S. dollar and the opportunities or need really to diversify and take advantage of potentially the ability to do trade transactions and eventually financial transactions in domestic currency. We see a slowdown in that really with market turmoil in 2015. And I think it's interesting that if we look at DSEP, it's initially focused on the domestic environment, but I think it's important that if we look at the central bank's new work program for this year, RMB internationalization has once again reappeared on that short list of major target projects. And what this says is that in addition to focusing on the domestic context, there's increasing thought on how this can be used internationally. And certainly here in the context of Hong Kong, a number of projects that are looking both at possible development of systems to interact with other currencies, but also from the standpoint of what is called the Greater Bay Area, which is basically southern China around Hong Kong, Macau, Shenzhen, Guangzhou, and increasing policy objective focusing on integration and how systems could be built that could bridge the freely open capital account in Hong Kong with the largely closed capital account within most of the rest of the region. And I think if we think about internationalization, it's very important to realize, first, as Charles said, that the target is actually eventually that the digital currency will eliminate all other forms. And what that means is that one then has, certainly within the context of China's digital environment, China's digital borders, essentially a perfectly controlled system that one will be able to perfectly track flows in and out. And so in many ways, it provides a very strong tool from the standpoint of maintaining a variety of gates or restrictions or controls, either to be able to put those back in quickly or to maintain them. The second, I think, is that when we think about the ability to use China's currencies outside of its border, one of the problems that emerged in sort of your first generation of RMB internationalization was that if you were going to allow it to be used outside of the borders, there was a real risk of potentially losing control of its use and essentially eroding controls on movement of money in and out. And I think DCEP and the idea of programmable money provides a range of alternatives. I think at this stage, there really isn't much discussion in China or anywhere in the world about building a sort of Bitcoin-type digital token that can freely circulate around the world for anybody to be used, Rather, I think the discussions that we're seeing in the context of DCEP are more likely to be around, as Charles highlighted, around trade flows. And in particular, one can think of existing swap line frameworks, which have been put in place with a range of jurisdictions around the world, that rather than allowing free transferability of the RMB outside of China's borders, rather, these corridors, these swap lines provide for corridors whereby the RMB area can extend elsewhere, but still largely be under control from the standpoint of policymakers within China. So I think from the standpoint of RMB internationalization, and in particular from the standpoint of building a system that could underlie not only BSN, but also other efforts like China International Payment System to internationalize use of the currency, DCEP is potentially very important. But I don't actually see any of these necessarily resulting in loss of control of either the monetary instrument or from the standpoint of capital controls.
Thank you, Douglas. I'll just combine the last two questions together. One way of doing this would be more iterative, maybe facilitating payments across, say, the Belt and Road regions. But to expand more broadly and globally, what do you see as the main challenges for the PBOC to solve for cross-border payments? We've already mentioned some of the macro fundamentals and the use of the renminbi, but could this be interoperability, agreeing on global standards and principles, harmonizing laws and regulations? And in this case, how will China position itself on the global stage with their counterparts on agreeing on some of these principles?
Thank you. I think part of the answer Dr. Arnor already gave you, right? And that really is the focus on trade accounts. I think BRI is incredibly important here, the so-called Belt and Road Initiative regions, because that's where we're going to see cross-border begin. In fact, has already done so. And that's where we're going to see a majority of this build. Okay. And the reason is because so much of BRI, particularly the infrastructure building aspects of it, actually require a tremendous amount of funding. And the ability for DCEP to generate smart funding solutions, to do a tracking of payments, and of course the ability to monitor then those ledgers makes actually so dramatically reduces the risk of doing BRI infrastructure investments. And that aspect of it will be such a large improvement on cost of capital that you almost can't avoid it. It will become such an attractive option relative to other cash and transfer alternatives that forget about it being strategic for China or not. It will simply be the cheapest way to get funding. And to go even a step farther than that, think about how these, you know, free trade zones work all over the world. It's not just in China, all over the world, in Dubai and so forth. You know, it's sort of these areas that belong to no one, right? And imagine that now expanding to BRI countries, whereby along the DCEP, RMB comes in and out of those zones, or even precisely to those particular companies and investments in a seamless way. Right? That the funding comes in RMB, it is paid back in RMB, the Chinese employees who are building that bridge or that power plant in whatever country, they're being paid in RMB, and it's just this closed loop or quasi-closed loop. And those are the sort of things where you're going to see very rapid and very large scale deployment. Again, as Dr. Arner very astutely pointed out, without necessarily dealing with these capital account issues and so forth, it's virtually a closed loop. And then you can start to imagine actually a sandbox that we're working on here at Fudan University down in Yiwu in the Zhejiang province, where a great deal of their trade is done in the African continent. And then you think about, well, Africa is a continent that has very, very well-developed players in the digital payment space. They're MSFs of the world and so forth. And those guys now get together with, let's say, a big-time Zhejiang payment platform, maybe like an Alipay, and say, look, let's do clearance. Trade only, no retail, no consumer, no travel, but along these trade lines and in these sort of closed systems, maybe we can do a solution, again, sitting against DCEP. So I think I'll flip around your question just a little bit. I mean, your question was really around what are the main challenges of PBOC. I actually view it a little bit differently. I view, at least along the Belt and Road, opportunities to create, to mimic a domestic transaction, but outside of the physical borders of, Greater China, and to be able to do that because DCEP is designed in such a way that has its own boundary, that those people who are on it are already part of and sort of on chain, if you will, that they are already registered in it in an appropriate way, such that they sort of entered, if you will, the borders of the DCEP, acting within that boundary. So rather than it becoming a challenge for PBOC, it actually is sort of bringing people into an environment where they're relatively comfortable. And of course, let's be importantly say, kind of calling the shots, if you will. So I think that maybe is a different way, a different perspective to view it. But the other is also well received, right? The issue of interoperability and agreeing on global standards. And I think, you know, China pushing out CBDC and its own standards so aggressively, really in March or so of 2020, really acted as, again, to use Dr. Arner's word, you know, acted as a catalyst for the G20 sort of to also start to come together and put together these global standards. Now, will it be something like the G20? Will it be a different organization that will play a role there? You know, I think that remains to be seen. And I think it is core that China be involved in that discussion. And from there, I'll just add the following point, that it is important that people view, regardless of interoperability and cross-border, that a digital central bank currency is still a sovereign currency. It is very important for people to understand, and not just, you know, of course, the leadership, but those that will be involved, that a digital currency is not the same thing as a cryptocurrency, right? That this is not an issue of decentralization and desovereignization of, you know, a unit of exchange or a numeraire, if you will. And I think that aspect or that sort of feel for that conversation will be very important, because I think the danger is that when you talk about global digital currency, that people will start to think, you know, does this, well, will this be impacted by issues of sovereignty and so forth? And I think that aspect is the real challenge in terms of, the, as you mentioned, the approach to global governance.
Thank you, Charles. Douglas, any final point from you, maybe on the governance? I mean, China doesn't want to have another SWIFT situation on their hands, where the US has a lot of influence on global payments. But any final points?
You know, I think what is part of the challenges here in some ways is going to be the evolution of CBDCs around the world. In other words, China's progress with the ECNY is very much driving the other major economies, particularly the EU, which is looking at a digital euro for almost exactly the same sorts of reasons as China. And likewise, discussions beginning in the United States. And I think as major economies move in this direction, the first challenge is going to be, of course, from the standpoint of interoperability. The second is going to be from the standpoint of other countries. If we look at International financial centers all across the world are already trying to figure out how to continue their role as intermediaries to build interoperability across payment and monetary systems in order to support their ongoing roles and competitiveness. You know, from the standpoint of many developed countries, as well as developing countries, there is going to be a real risk of currency substitution. The fact that it may become much easier with the rollout of major country, major economy CBDCs to use those instead of their domestic currencies. And that, I think, is going to be a major challenge for countries around the world. And I think from both of these standpoints, something that international organizations such as the IMF or the Bank for International Settlements, the G20, or even the UN project that I mentioned, are all increasingly thinking about the implications. And I think the positive implications are very, very important and have been recognized by the G20, the BIS, FSB in trying to drive forward new technologies to support cross-border payments. But just as there are the opportunities to better support global integration to reduce costs, there are likewise increasing opportunities or risks of fragmentation into a range of different non-interoperable monetary areas. And so I think from the standpoint of challenges, the technology, yes, interoperability is going to be central, and likewise, I think the geopolitics.
On that final point, this concludes today's podcast and the second part of this discussion. Thank you for joining us today, Charles and Douglas. It's been a pleasure to speak with you again. If you've enjoyed the podcast, please subscribe to our channel. We are both on iTunes and Spotify.
Thank you for listening to the OMFIF podcast.